From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Governor Rick Snyder and several people from his administration face criminal charges for their parts in the Flint water crisis.
This was not a simple case of government officials doing the best they could and making a mistake. These were government officials who intended to advance an agenda, and in advancing that agenda, threatened and ultimately harmed human life.
Also, looking for clues in the early life and activism of a Wolverine Watchman.
When you get that positive reinforcement and you're angry and you're lonely and you're desperate, that may act as an accelerant.
And the longtime head of the Detroit Zoo retires after nearly three decades.
There may be a misconception that cultural institutions like a zoo or a museum are stagnant. Good ones are not.
Those conversations coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a former state prosecutor talks about the new charges against public officials, including former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder in the Flint water crisis. We have details later in the show, but first, as many of us watched clips of huge crowds showing open vitriol at the U.S. Capitol last week, it was hard not to think about Michigan's experience last spring and summer. Protests in Lansing over public health restrictions drew angry crowds, some of them armed to the teeth, and about a dozen defendants are still facing federal and state charges for the anti-government plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Many of those charged were there in Lansing on April 30th. The Detroit Free Press has just published a profile of one of the so-called Wolverine Watchmen, Adam Fox from Wyoming, Michigan. Longtime Detroit reporter M.L. Elric wrote the story. ML, welcome back to Stateside.
It's great to be here.
Adam Fox is a young man who we have heard a bit about. You spoke with a family friend who took Fox under his wing for an earlier story. And the court documents for this case suggest that Adam Fox was seen, if not as something of a leader within the group, at least someone who was often trying to get the group to some kind of consensus. Who did you talk to for this profile? His friends or family?
Well, his grandmother's passed on, but I did use a lot of information that appeared in her obituary, and it seems that she was a wonderful person. And his uncle, Adam Fox's uncle, feels that his mother, meaning the uncle's mother, Adam Fox's grandmother, that her passing may have been one of the things that unmoored his nephew. One of the things that I think is really interesting, and of course I've been thrown off his grandfather's porch by his grandfather and his mother. They refused to talk to me, even to say something nice about Mr. Fox. But his uncle was gracious enough, and I think, frankly, smart enough to realize that no one was saying anything that would tell the other side of Adam Fox. He loves his nephew very much. But he also was concerned about some of the more strident things he was hearing from his nephew and seeing from his nephew over the last couple years. And I think one of the things that his uncle did was both provide us some more humanizing information about Mr. Fox, but also provided us a real look from someone who was an eyewitness to this, if you will, devolution into a somewhat paranoid mindset.
Adam Fox was someone who had a pretty rough early life. His parents were split, and he kind of bounced back and forth sometimes. How do we get from the kid who was dealing with this hardship to the ripped, bearded guy who posed for so many photos with guns?
That's the crucial question. I mean, my parents split when I was very young. I think I had better luck with male role models, perhaps, although As I think people who read this story in the Free Press will see, his uncle was a very positive influence on his life. But lots of people have tough upbringings. How some of them become cops and priests and university presidents and inventors and CEOs, and some of them become conspiracy theorists living in vacuum store basements and plotting the kidnap of chief executives of major governments. That's a question that I think a team of psychiatrists would have trouble answering in any short order. But I do think there are some factors here that may have accelerated that transformation. One of them is we're all isolated. We can't interact with other people. And one of the things that I've found in my business life, is that when you don't see people face to face, it's very easy to view them as monsters or as less human than you are. And the other thing is people are reaching out to like-minded folks in these online communities that have existed, you know, ever since we've had the internet, going back to bulletin boards, you know, and they have become more tightly knit, more insular. And I think this echo chamber effect where you say something that may seem a little edgy and all you hear is, yeah, 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 turns people who may have not had leadership qualities, as Mr. Fox was said not to have. But when you get that positive reinforcement and you're angry and you're lonely and you're desperate, that may act as an accelerant. It may act like something where somebody says, hey, you know what? I'm mad and it's okay. And I said this thing that sounded a little crazy to me, but other people think it doesn't sound so crazy. So maybe it's not so crazy. So let me say something crazier and they'll all cheer. And maybe it's not so crazy. Maybe we do it. But listen, the only time I've spent with psychiatry was as a patient. So don't take my word for this stuff.
At what point would you say that Adam Fox's views progressed beyond, you know, the general anti-government sentiment that's not terribly uncommon in Michigan, and became radicalized? Did his uncle have any insights about that?
Yes, he feels that from the time that his Adam's grandmother passed away in late 2018, that he seemed a little, I said unmoored before, and I think that's the right term, that he was a little bit adrift, and that he also had been taking for some time a lot of pride in his appearance. You know, he's a big, handsome dude. So at least he takes a better mugshot than some of the other guys. But he started to, you know, really become interested. You know, I mean, maybe there's a little narcissism there. I mean, certainly we all want to work out and take care of ourselves. But it seems like he became more interested in his appearance and his physical fitness. And then when the gyms were shut down, his uncle theorizes that that was one of those things where he just said, that's the last straw. You know, this is the one place I can go where I feel pretty positive and I enjoy being there. And now I can't even do that. So it really does seem like sometime between late 2018 and early 2020, he may have been bobbing along sort of on some troubled waters, but it was in the spring of 2020 that things got pretty choppy.
Are there any questions that you have left about him that we might learn more about in the federal case?
Oh my goodness. I mean, I have, you know, I'm like you, all I have is questions and not nearly enough answers. In fact, you know, most of the public records that I was able to find, no one else knew about. Even Adam's uncle didn't know about his mother's abortive divorce or her bankruptcy or her husband's bankruptcy, or Adam's juvenile case. But those cases are so old that the detailed records don't exist. So, I mean, I have questions about cases that are 20 years old, but one of the things that I think is going to come out in this case is we're going to see more of the transcripts from some of the deleted social media communications. They used encrypted apps and they were very aware that they may be penetrated. So some of the things that the tracks they tried to cover, of course, you know, you really can't do that. I think that what comes out of there will be very interesting. And I think really more than anything, I'm interested to see his demeanor, because when we spent several hours in court in Grand Rapids back in October, he seemed nonplussed. Most people facing a potential life sentence, particularly people who are described as not necessarily charismatic or head of the pack type dogs. You know, I've seen real tough guys in court basically get meek and mild, as a lot of these other guys were, because the gravity of what was in front of them hit them. That doesn't seem to have hit Adam Fox yet. So I'm going to be interested to see what the evolution is. I also think there's a possibility that there will be a superseding indictment, which means they will add more charges. And if that happens, you know, the weight of this thing may start to bear on his broad shoulders.
We've heard of Michigan's 2020 experience with these guys like Adam Fox as being a canary in the coal mine for the insurrection that happened in Washington, D.C. Do you see that line?
I can draw a direct line. There's a fellow named Brian Cash. He was seen on newspapers and websites across the country shouting into the Senate gallery. He's got a beard and he looked quite exercised. He was someone who we had on my podcast and seemed to be, you know, a pretty animated guy, but not completely unhinged. Well, he was in Washington. So you can draw a straight line between him being at the Michigan Capitol trying to breach the wall and being in the U.S. Capitol vicinity. I don't know if he got in the Capitol or not. I think he did. But there's someone who went from Michigan to the Capitol, the U.S. Capitol, in January. There's no question that, these are almost like Russian nesting dolls, and the little state capitol insurrections are the big doll. And when you pull it all apart, you get to that little hard doll that no one can break down in the middle. And that's the one in Washington, the one that the nut that we're not able to crack.
Hmm. ML, you made the rather dramatic pronouncement that this story about Adam Fox may well be your last work of journalism. You're running for Detroit City Council, District 4. As a reporter, I know you to be a glutton for punishment because you are a reporter. But why else are you moving into public service?
Sure. And I like the way you put that, because that's exactly what it is. It's public service. What I've been doing for the last 28 years is public service. I've been holding politicians and elected officials and public officials, public servants accountable. And I've been doing that in just about every medium available at every level of government. And it seems more and more that work is having less effect. How many politicians or public officials do you reach out to who just refuse to answer your questions? They don't think that they have to speak to the public, because really we are the medium through which elected officials and public officials communicate with the public. I'm also more involved in my neighborhood than I ever have been before. I'm on the executive board. I've been a school board commission. I've been a coach in various youth leagues. And those things mean more and more to me. And I've always done them on the side, but that sort of community involvement, that sort of commitment where you actually have your hands in the dirt or pushing the lawnmower in my case, I want to make that more of my life. And I want to continue to be a resource for people who are trying to get answers and help from government. And I just think as a reporter, I've taken that about as far as I can. And so I'm looking for another way, another capacity to help.
Reporter M.L. Elric, most recently of the Detroit Free Press. After the break, we'll speak with the man who's run the Detroit Zoo for decades. We'll be right back. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Many of us have really fond childhood memories of visiting the zoo. However, over the years, our views on zoos have evolved from a focus on visitor curiosity and entertainment into conservation. Ron Kagan helped to push innovations for both people and animals during his 28 years as head of the Detroit Zoo, the largest in Michigan. Ron recently announced he's going to retire this summer, and he joins us now. Ron, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
You've been working with the zoo for nearly 30 years, but your calendar age is still pretty young as far as being in a position of leadership. How did you make the decision to retire?
Well, I decided not to follow in the footsteps of my beloved grandfather, who retired when he was 102. And I thought, I am never going to be able to catch up to that. So,
what did your grandfather do for a living?
Well, he was in England, and he owned, with his young brother, Max, who was 95 at the time, a textile factory. And they together decided it was time to retire.
For your sake, I'm glad that you're not following the family tradition, but were there concerns that were related to the pandemic or more to your family situation that informed this?
No concerns at all. And I think it's interesting in life. I don't know how often it happens, but that you will actually leave something that you love dearly. So I don't know that there really is a right time. And obviously, I have been thinking about it for a while. The pandemic actually slowed down this process a little bit for me, because obviously I did not want to leave the organization when it was struggling through the pandemic. And I'm hopeful that by the summer, we will be in a much better shape just all around.
Will you tell us the story of how you came into your role as the zoo's leader?
Well, I was recruited. I was working at the Dallas Zoo at the time as the general curator, and I really had not thought about Detroit. And at the time, both the city here and also the zoo, I think were on hard times. But when I came up and met with various leaders and got to know the community a little bit, I was intrigued and especially found it very compelling that there was a long tradition of the community really caring about cultural institutions here. And I thought that with that as a foundation, that there was a lot of opportunity to bring this organization forward. And I'm really pleased that I made that decision, because I think that my assessment turned out to be right. And I think we've done a lot of really important things here, and it's because we've had so much tremendous support.
There have been a lot of notable changes at the Detroit Zoo during your time. Maybe most notably, the end of the zoo's elephant program, which was a first-in-the-nation move for a cold-weather zoo like Detroit's. Will you tell us about that decision?
Sure. You know, I think there may be a misconception that cultural institutions like a zoo or a museum are stagnant, and good ones are not. So all of us are always on a journey, and it sounds trite, but it's a never-ending journey. So the elephant decision in 2004 was not a radical decision for us, because we were on a journey and had been for quite a while to really focus on clarity. The clarity that animals who live in zoos should be thriving. And if for some reason they're not, or indeed if we don't think they can thrive, then they should not be in zoos, in our opinion. So for us, we had done what we do for everything here, which is constantly work on improvements, not just for animals, obviously for visitors too, but improvements for the animals, and in the case of the elephants, a number of times of major expansion of their facility, changes in protocols, many, many changes. And every time we did it, we would feel that while it seemed like a big change in terms of people, it wasn't really a big change in terms of the experience for an elephant. And we finally said, you know, this is really not going to make a significant difference for the elephants. So we had a lot of discussion internally, and then we had discussion with our community, and we explained to them that they didn't see it, but we sure did, that the elephants were not thriving and would not thrive despite everyone's best efforts. And we said, we need to stop doing this. So we did.
Can you give us an example of ways that staff knew that things really hadn't changed for the elephants?
Well, I think we saw the same problems that zoos have seen for many, many decades, you know, whether it's animals developing arthritis, animals developing foot problems, behavioral issues, you know, and it's common sense that if an animal naturally is walking all of the time, and it has nowhere to walk, and by nowhere, you know, having an acre or two might sound like a lot to a person, but to an elephant, it's nothing. So aside from the science of all of this, there's a lot of common sense that absolutely needs to be involved in decisions like this. And the common sense reinforced what we were seeing, which is that we didn't see improvements in the animal's behavior or life expectancy or really any other kind of measure that you would look at.
I heard a story that you still keep one of the poles that trainers used to use back in the day to prod elephants. You keep that in your office as a reminder?
Yeah, it's called an ankus, yeah. And it's a rod with a hooked metal tip at the end. And the idea that for so long, we, and I mean that in the broadest sense, not obviously just Detroit, but that zoos basically controlled elephants by chaining them and by physical discipline. It's really appalling when you actually think about this. And we wouldn't dare do this for anything else, nor should we. So I keep that as a reminder. And unfortunately, it's still being used in some places around the country here and certainly abroad.
There have been so many years of American history and civilized history in which we viewed wild animals as something for entertainment value in circuses or smaller zoos. But these days, there's been a sea change that zoos can be about conservation and that bigger enclosures and more humane pastoral settings might be more important than entertainment value. When did you become aware that this shift was happening and that this was going to be a focus of your career, to talk to people about conservation rather than just enjoying the animals?
Well, I think pretty early on in my career, and I think it's important for your listeners to know that there are, you know, a little bit over 200 accredited zoos in the U.S., but there are about 2,000 other places in the U.S. that actually have exotic animals. Now, most of those do not have elephants, but there's a big distinction here. Yes, there are zoos that are really focused on conservation and indeed on animal welfare. And those are the accredited zoos by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. But there are many, many others that don't hold those values. And indeed, it is entirely a commercial venture or simply a very selfish venture that people want to own exotic animals. This is one of the big challenges. We've had to rescue hundreds of exotic animals from all sorts of crazy situations because we don't have enough federal regulation in this country to prevent that. And there are continuing efforts to do new legislation, but it seems ridiculously tough to get them done. I think it was very clear to me towards the very beginning of my career that a lot of changes needed to happen and that we fall into the trap of being selfish. We really want to be around other species, and that's certainly understandable, but the issue is it should not be at their expense. You know, back in the day when I started over 40 years ago, there were lots and lots of situations that just, as I said earlier, in terms of common sense, defied any type of logic. Keeping polar bears in South Texas. Mm-hmm. I mean, how ridiculous. So we've come a long way and there's a long way to go. I'm happy that the science actually has caught up because the science of conservation is robust and has been for a while and continues to get better. The science of animal welfare and the field of animal ethics, those are still relatively new in the world of zoos and aquariums, not in the world of agriculture and some other places, but that advance is hugely important.
If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Ron Kagan, longtime head of the Detroit Zoo. Earlier this month, he announced that he's planning to retire this summer. There are now many biologists and other scientists who do see zoos as having an important role in showing people about animals and in instructing them and helping them understand the threats to habitat. How do you think about our balance between providing a user experience that people enjoy with their families and providing that experience for animals? You talked a little bit about just making sure that the animals are thriving, but what are some of the benchmarks that you and your staff talk about these days?
Well, I think that is really, in a lot of ways, the most important challenge for zoos and aquariums, to face the question you've just posed and to deal with it. And what that means is to really be rigorous, challenging ourselves. So it starts with, well, what species should live wherever you are? And sometimes it's as simple as, well, this is totally the wrong climate for certain animals. Obviously, if we're talking about a frog, it's not that hard to create a tremendous physical environment. And again, I want to reemphasize, it's not just about physical environment, but if it's a very small animal, one should be able to create a reasonable space, an optimal space. But what that does mean is that, you know, we can't be the menagerie that has every type of big cat or every type of primate or every type of parrot. The first and foremost thing has to be quality. And it's not just about quality for the animals. It's indeed about quality for the visitor as well. But we need to stop the trap of thinking that we have to do instant gratification for a visitor otherwise they won't be happy. And to some extent, we're at fault for that, for shaping those expectations that you won't have to spend more than 30 seconds to find an animal in a particular habitat or exhibit. And if you do have to spend more than 30 seconds, then it's okay to be frustrated and to think, well, there aren't any animals at the zoo. That is an ongoing challenge for zoos. And I think we have to be much more creative about how we are presenting the situation. And we've got to be honest with people that, you know, you can come with us to Africa to see mountain gorillas, and you will spend a lot of money, and you'll spend 2 weeks. And if you're lucky, you'll have 30 or 40 minutes to see the mountain gorillas after you've climbed a mosquito-infested mountain. Or you can spend 15 or 20 minutes here walking around a multi-acre facility until you find the gorillas. To me, this is just us not being as effective as we need to be in preparing people properly for what it can be to have a great experience for us and a great experience for the animals.
What will you miss most about being at the zoo?
Oh, probably everything. So, you know, really, this is such a wonderful place. And it's such a joy to work with all of these really devoted, passionate people who think a lot about what's important. So I'll miss that. And of course, I'll miss a lot of the wonderful things that we've developed here and the programs that we've developed. And obviously the animals. Yesterday I was in with the penguin staff and the penguins, and I sit there and I'm just beaming with joy because, and missing Antarctica too. But
you visited Antarctica, for those who may not know the story.
Yeah, I've been fortunate. I've been to Antarctica 5 or 6 times and many other places in the field. And, you know, I'm sure I will miss everything.
You know, as we think about the public's perception of the zoo, we should talk a little bit about where things might be headed in the next couple of decades. But I wonder, first of all, how some of your colleagues, some of the other zoos have come to view what you're doing in Detroit.
Boy, that's tough to answer. I mean, I think some probably feel like we have done something important by moving the discussion forward on things like animal welfare and ethics and sustainability and other important issues. I think for some, we opened some conversations that were awkward, and they may not have appreciated that at the time, but I think you're going to have to ask other people.
Do you see zoos, and maybe also the folks who visit them, as having changed over this time?
Oh, for sure. I think there is far more professionalism. There always have been very, very bright leaders in this profession, legendary people like Bill Conway and George Rabb from Wildlife Conservation Society and from the Brookfield Zoo and many others. But I do think that there is far more science and there's far more sensibility. And the other really wonderful thing that's happened during the years I've worked in this profession is the tremendous influx of women. And just as we've seen that in field conservation and how that has been kind of revolutionary, you know, Jane Goodall being one of the first, but by no means the only, I think that there are so many more women now in key positions in the zoo world, and that has been a tremendous improvement for how people approach things, in my view, far more thoughtfully and with a balance of science and compassion.
So with all that in mind, what do you think should be in the future plan for the Detroit Zoo?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think aware enough of things like ego to know that it would be silly to ask for or expect or even want somebody to continue exactly what I've been doing. I do hope there will be more science. I hope there will be a lot more focus on ethics and animal welfare, not just conservation work. And I think whoever comes here next just needs to advance their view of what is really important. So this zoo has become a sanctuary, and it is an organization that thinks a lot about the individuality of animals, not just what's best for an entire species or population. Hopefully those things will continue, but I really don't know what the next leader will bring in terms of key focus areas.
Ron Kagan, it's really been a pleasure talking to you, and we hope to see you again around the community after your retirement.
Thank you.
Still to come, state prosecutors who scrapped the initial Flint water investigation have wrapped up a new inquiry and filed charges.
And it looks like they've essentially followed through on what they said they were going to do, which was look through more documents, gather more evidence, and come back later with more charges.
More on that story in just a moment. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Nine individuals were indicted today on criminal charges related to the Flint water crisis, including former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder. Many of the names of those who were charged will be names that you've heard before. This is one of several cases seeking justice for all the people in Flint who suffered everything from skin lesions to brain damage and more because of tainted water flowing through their city's system. State Attorney General Dana Nessel has presided over the latest stages of the inquiry. Our guest today is Noah Hall. He's a professor of law at Wayne State University and a former state prosecutor who was involved in the initial independent investigation of state officials. Noah, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just roll this back a few steps for those who may be just picking up the story. How does what happened in the Snyder administration in 2014 relate to these charges today?
Well, so actually the decisions made in the Snyder administration that led to these charges probably began back in 2012 and 2013 when the Snyder administration began the process of taking over the city of Flint through emergency management and ultimately directing the city of Flint to join a new water authority, indebt itself with bonds to pay for a new water supply, which eventually led to the need to use the Flint River and the decision to not use corrosion control in 2014.
Yeah. We should say that you parted ways with the Attorney General's office in 2019 before the decision was made to drop the initial charges and restart the investigation. With that in mind, can I ask, what's your take on AG Nessel's decision to open a new investigation?
Sure. Well, actually, as far as I know, it was the decision to terminate the prior investigation and restart it was made by Attorney General Nessel or Solicitor General Fadwa Hamoud, not Governor Gretchen Whitmer, at least as far as I know. And at the time, I was both frustrated that the existing investigation had been shut down, especially after we had really achieved some pretty big initial successes in court advancing the cases. And I was skeptical that the Attorney General was shutting down our investigation with the intent of bringing it back better in the future. I'm happy I was wrong. It looks today like my skepticism was not justified, and Attorney General Nessel came through on what she promised, which was when she shut down our investigation and terminated us, myself included, she really was building back a better investigation that was going to do more work and go even further with developing charges. And it looks like that's exactly what's happened over the past 2 years.
Arguably, the top line in this story is that a former governor, Rick Snyder, is now facing a misdemeanor charge. Do you see that as a step toward accountability?
Yes, tremendously. And I very much appreciate the frustration, especially from folks in Flint who've seen loved ones die, who've seen loved ones' quality of life destroyed, who've seen their own households destroyed, not to mention what's happened to the community in Flint. I absolutely understand the frustration that the former governor is facing, as they would put it, only misdemeanor charges. And given the seriousness of what happened in Flint and the loss of life, I could see the frustration in the governor only facing misdemeanor charges. As somebody who's been skeptical and critical of Attorney General Nessel's team's work over the past 2 years, I would actually, at this point now, suggest that folks at least give the prosecution a little bit of time and give the process a little bit of time to see how the charges, these misdemeanor charges, will develop in future proceedings. We might very well see additional evidence come to light that will warrant even more significant charges against the governor.
By comparison, there are some very serious charges aimed at Nick Lyon, the former head of Michigan DHHS, and his former chief medical officer, Dr. Eden Wells, each facing 9 counts of involuntary manslaughter. What would prosecutors have to prove in order to get a conviction on these very serious charges? And do you think that they can do it?
Sure. Not only, of course, are all defendants entitled to a presumption of innocence, but I don't have access to the information that was submitted to the grand jury. But just going on both the public information and the information, the evidence that we introduced during our first investigation and preliminary hearings, we filed charges against Nick Lyon for involuntary manslaughter. And advanced those charges through preliminary hearing in front of a district judge. And the district judge ultimately made the decision that there was sufficient evidence to warrant a full trial on involuntary manslaughter against former Director of Health and Human Services, Nick Lyon. And so now we're seeing those charges come back. It looks like they're bringing additional charges for manslaughter of additional individuals, more victims of the Legionnaires' disease. And it looks like they also will have even more evidence to demonstrate the alleged crime that occurred. From the evidence that we've already seen come into court, though, the prosecution has in the past already established that Nick Lyon had a duty to protect public health, had the information available to do so, and for reasons that have nothing to do with public health administration or science, made the decision to not inform the public, as well as the medical community, about the ongoing risk of Legionnaires' disease. And at least during the first stage of the investigation and prosecution, the district judge saw enough evidence that Nick Lyon failed to protect human health and make decisions that cost human life to warrant standing trial on involuntary manslaughter. If the new prosecution team has additional evidence and has documented additional loss of life from those decisions, I expect them to get similar results in court.
The state archivist told the Associated Press that what's happening right now has never happened before, that former governors have never faced criminal charges for things that they did in office. Can we assume that that is by design? Is there any benefit of doubt that we need to offer our state's executives, maybe beyond the governor, that the decisions they're making might be the best they have at the time?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. And this is a question I know that a lot of folks, even in government and outside of government, are going to be thinking about as this case unfolds. But I hope people will take the time to see the facts as they play out in these proceedings. As the facts will begin to come to light and the full story will be told, I don't think you're going to see government officials making the best decisions they could at the time, and simply in retrospect, they were wrong. I think the facts and the evidence are going to show far more intentional wrongdoing. You're going to see conspiracies. You're going to see obstruction of justice. You're going to see coordinated, ongoing efforts to advance one agenda and discredit both public opponents and minimize the harm that was being created in the community. The system and the process to demonstrate all of these facts, and folks will be able to make their own conclusions as they see the trials unfold. But this was not a simple case of government officials doing the best they could and making a mistake. Quite the opposite. These were government officials who intended to advance an agenda, and in advancing that agenda, threatened and ultimately harmed human life.
Noah, what do you think this process will deliver that hasn't happened already in the years of legal wrangling over what happened in Flint?
From the time I spent working in Flint and trying to give that community some sense of justice, how important it is for the people of Flint to see the state of Michigan, whether it's the Attorney General's office or some other clear sign of authority from the state of Michigan, finally say to this community that what happened to you was wrong. And, you know, I don't want to celebrate charges being filed because you don't want to celebrate a crime having occurred. You don't want to celebrate that somebody broke the law and somebody lost their life as a result of it. But I am very happy and relieved for the people of Flint that they are getting some vindication and some acknowledgement from their state that what was done to them was wrong and that they're going to hold people accountable.
Noah Hall is a professor of law at Wayne State University. Noah, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Anna Clark is a reporter with ProPublica, and for many years she pursued the story of Flint's water crisis as an independent journalist. She's the author of The Poison City, Flint's Water and the American Urban Tragedy. Anna Clark, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Can we step back to the point at which state prosecutors announced that they were throwing out the prior cases against eight defendants and just starting all over again? How was that news received in Flint?
With a great deal of ambivalence, as you can imagine. This was about a year and a half ago, in the middle of 2019. So at that point, the first wave of the criminal investigation had been going on for 3.5 years and had spent many, many millions in public dollars for the both the investigation as well as the defense of these public servants. And suddenly it all fizzled down to nothing is what it seemed like. At the very beginning, the current attorney general and her team announced that, you know, they were very serious about continuing the investigation. They just wanted to start from scratch. They felt that a great deal of the evidence hadn't been scrutinized appropriately, and that they were going to begin at the beginning, and if there were charges to be filed, they would be ones that they felt would hold up in court, is what they said. And so for folks in the community, at least from what I heard, I mean, there are people who were just emotionally drained and sometimes, and in many cases, quite angry at feeling kind of jerked around with this, and also doubtful, not sure how serious to take the promises that this second investigation would be effective in bringing accountability to this water crisis. And some folks did feel hopeful, did appreciate their the team did a kind of a town hall in Flint, and they were eventually opened an office in Flint. And, you know, some people took that as some signs as, well, maybe something's going to go forward with this. We'll see. Just there was a lot of like cautious, skeptical watchfulness. And then that the second wave of the investigation has been very tight-lipped ever since, up until just a couple days ago. I mean, there was no real clarity on where it was or what it was doing or what was going on until, of course, the breaking news right now.
Indeed. Well, we know that this is a case that has occupied a lot of the state's time, attention, and money, both defending and prosecuting the case. But let's turn this around. For Flint residents, what's it been like for them?
in watching this go forward? I mean, well, it's just, it's incredibly stressful. I mean, I feel like people very reasonably want people to be held accountable for the actual choices they made that caused actual harm. That is a reasonable thing for people to expect and want. And it's been one of the very peculiar legacies of the Flint water crisis that has been utterly undone up until this point. The folks I've talked to feel like aren't really sure where to place their emotions. They're very clear that whatever charges are filed or whatever convictions are done, it doesn't make everything right. I mean, the health consequences for the children, especially who were exposed to toxic water, are lifelong and incurable. And so, I mean, there's like that doesn't go away. But people are very, very hungry for people to be held accountable for the actions that led to this crisis for themselves, their families, their children, their neighbors, the town that they've chosen as their home. And for any meaningful healing to happen, that's critical. You just have to have accountability.
Flint is getting close, but the work to replace all of its lead service lines is still not done. And for the most part, the story has faded from a lot of media coverage. Do you think that moving these charges back into the news means something new for the sense of urgency in finally dealing with the consequences of the switch to the Flint River? I mean, this happened almost 6 years ago now.
It's amazing. It is amazing. You're right. There's the replacement of the water pipes has been another sort of ongoing story. They've replaced, as of late December, I think close to 10,000 of the lead lines, which is great, but it's not quite yet complete. And of course, it needs to be complete. And that's when people think about whether the Flint water crisis is over, that seems like square one. this infrastructure that caused so much harm to people that was worsened and damaged by the choices that decision makers made with the water. So if it brings more urgency to the very practical needs of folks in the community, whether that is involving the pipes, education, health services, access to healthcare, and other sorts of wraparound services that are necessary to thrive and flourish, I would be glad to see it.
Have you been able to stay in touch with any of the families that suffered health problems as a result of this?
Some, though I have to be honest and be like not in a day-to-day way. But I think that for the folks that I have kept in touch with who have been struggling with a number of health issues, I mean, they feel very frustrated with the fact that the spotlight has moved away, where a lot of people are just assuming that the water crisis is, quote, over because so much time has passed and because there have been some progress made on some of the remedies when they live in a day-to-day way with conditions that they attribute to the water that cause a great deal of pain and suffering for themselves. I think that lived consequences of this water crisis is something that it's incalculable, and it will be years before I think maybe we can fully process all of it, where we really see what the full stakes have been for folks.
Reporter Anna Clark with ProPublica. Anna, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
In the past 12 months, there has been no shortage of news. But still, we want you to know the door is open. We would love to hear from you about what you want to hear on Stateside. Are there things happening in your corner of Michigan that you think we ought to know about? Maybe you just want to connect with other listeners about a segment that you really liked. You can do that by following us on social media. Find us on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. I'm on there, too. You can follow me, April Bear, at April Bear, B-A-E-R. And you can also find us on Facebook. Just search Michigan Radio. And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, and April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our interns are Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. The executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Bear. Thanks for being here. We'll see you tomorrow.